Hi, I'm Caroline. I'll introduce myself in a second. This is Antonia, and this is our talk, Design in 5 Minutes, okay, 20 Minutes. We're going to be covering ecosystem mapping and user research. We're really excited to be here. We did design this talk for folks that are new to design, but if you have a long experience with design, I think we have some really interesting case studies for y'all. So yeah. I am Caroline Senders. I'm the founder and principal designer of Convocation Research and Design.
And I'm Antonia Valencia, the design researcher in Convocation Research and Design. So today we're here to talk about open source projects. And many times when we think of open source projects, this can be or seem a little bit like a multiplayer game. So there's many contributors, everyone is participating, and it's sometimes beautiful, sometimes very chaotic. You fix one bug, another one appears, somebody does a request at 3 a.m., but it's kind of the magic, right? But for your project to really thrive in this ecosystem, you really need to understand the broader picture. So where does it actually fit? So again, an open source project really exists in a vacuum. Everything is connected. You're building tools, libraries, platforms, you're contributing to different web or other projects, technologies, and collaborating with people. So design really has this capability of building bridges. So knowing where your project fits within this nice ecosystem, it's not something, it's not like a nice to have, but it's something essential. Understanding where it fits, how you can collaborate, and the perspective of design is very important for this building of the ecosystem mapping. So it's going to become, let's hope, one of a key element in your design process. So we like to think of ecosystem mapping as a calling of an API between your project and the environment that it actually exists inside. So what are the dependencies? How does it connect to? Who are the users, the contributors, the monitors? This is something key. So how do humans actually interact within this whole system? So building this map of connections and identifying the relationships will actually situate your project within this ecosystem that surrounds it. And it's also going to help you find potential collaborators, competitors even, and hopefully understand the interactions of use of your users and of everyone around it. So now let's dive into the things that you can do right now that is going to be map out your ecosystem and also try to debug this human experience and interactions.
Oh yeah, sorry. And then now we're, yes. So thinking about what actually does it take to do ecosystem mapping? So this is where I think it's important to define the scope and objectives of your project. A lot of you probably do that, but it's always good to sort of like write it out explicitly for the entire team you're working with. I think the next step is important to then figure out who are the key stakeholders and communities that are either going to be involved in the project or will utilize it. Then I think it's important to analyze the interaction. What I mean by that is how will people engage with it, but also like what are potential interactions with similar projects, with dissimilar projects? Where do you sort of sit in a space of, let's say, the entire community? Where are there places to leverage collaborations? And where are there also potentials to sort of say, like, actually, even though this seems really similar to us, we're actually doing this very, very different kind of thing, even if it's on, let's say, like it's a similar programming language or a similar, again, type of project. And then lastly, documenting findings and insights for your team. So sort of taking all this together and presenting it back to think about how do we position ourselves not only inside of an ecosystem, but also how do we talk about with our community where we think the project also fits. And we're gonna get a little more into this. So these next steps are gonna focus on, it's almost like a deeper dive into steps 2 and 3. Mapping just isn't about coder dependencies, it's also very much about people. And thinking about people is this experience of thinking about these invisible bugs. why aren't new contributors contributing or sticking around? What are the barriers they're facing to engaging with a project? How do you balance sort of onboarding, let's say, new community members who have a variety of different backgrounds or skills? Does your project have space for like less technical and more technical folks? How do you want to engage with them? How would you like them to engage with the project? What are barriers for people, again, understanding the project? Is it just language, or is it how to actually find, let's say, materials about the project? I think all these things are really, really important, and this is also where we're going to get into user research to understand your community more or understand who's actually using the project. So user research, tips and tricks. So what is user research? Something we could call qualitative research, or I like to think of it as talking to people or engaging with your community. It involves things like interviews, focus groups, surveys. In some cases, you might do something called diary studies, where folks will be sort of writing down how they're engaging with something on a day-to-day basis, but also uses a variety of other tools. And so here's what I kind of, or what we sort of think of as the barest of bones of user research. So, and it also I think helps to define like why you would do it. So it helps us identify a problem or a focus area to outline what it is you're doing. It helps us understand why. What I like to often say is, how do you know? How do you know that this is a problem? An answer could be, well, we saw people complaining on GitHub or to our volunteers, or we just saw things online across a variety of spaces. And so then we spoke to a few people that complained or had thoughts. This is a great way to sort of validate, how do you know? But it's also, one of the most important things. There's a problem, how do you know it's a problem? Where did it come from? And then the next step is responding to that problem, to create a goal. And what I mean by goal is like, what are the next steps? What would you like to solve? How do you start to distill that into, let's say, an area to focus, like a question? Just really sort of narrowing that down. So a goal can be like, we know that users keep repeating the same mistake. Maybe it's maybe when they're engaging with a certain API using too large of a data set. Why are they doing that? And you know, then it could be, and we know this because we got X complaints. So the goal might be, we need to learn or understand better how this mistake keeps sort of refracting inside the community over and over again. Our goal is to understand more and try to come up with a solution. Then the last thing is a plan, or not the last thing, sorry, but then you can create a plan towards actually engaging with users and interviewing them. That could be, we decided to run a short survey, or we decided to speak to like 20 users, some who are much older users who are maybe higher impact contributors, and newer users. What are their experiences and how do they differ? How does someone have a lot more knowledge about a project than others, right? Then it's from that plan, synthesizing results. What did you find? What are the patterns? What do the patterns tell us? And so then it's sort of taking all of these things for next steps to think about what a solution is. So validate findings, right? Say, this is our thought of next steps of our solution. What does the community think? Ask for feedback. And then so on and so forth.
All right, so now that we got a first look at user research, we go back into ecosystem mapping. So this really comes into play when you start understanding who is around your project, who are the users that are going to be interacting with it. So here are the tips and tricks for ecosystem mapping. To make this ecosystem thinking part of your process, you first need to start mapping early. So don't wait until your project has so much complexity that it's going to be hard to jot it down on a piece of paper or a map or whatever means you end up using. Then you can keep it simple. So you can even do a hand-drawn map to try to put down these interactions. Then share and update these maps. It's a live document. It's never going to be a static piece. And finally, involve your community. So mapping is always better done with different perspectives, different opinions, and start doing all of this collaboratively. So why ecosystem mapping? So this tool really helps you understand what else is out there, what is similar, what is dissimilar, what makes your project stand out between the rest. It also helps you understand challenges that other projects have already undergone and how they really took a particular view or a focus. It also helps you visualize the gaps in this ecosystem and find the opportunities where your project or your community could try to help fill. And it allows you to understand and explain the why, and why this project in particular. What are the characteristics that make it different from the rest? And finally, it really allows you to engage in a companionship, in working together to build this tool and building your project in a more wide view. So to further understand this tool, we're going to present two case studies. The first one of them is the Red de Creatividad Digital, which is a project done with school teachers in Puerto Williams, Chile, together with the Fab Lab Austral, which is the Fab Lab in this island in Chile. And this project was situated in a very particular context, first of all. It was in a remote island at the end of Chile, in the southernmost Fab Lab in the world. So it has very particular characteristics. This island is very small, but it has like very different stakeholders inside of the island. And we use this ecosystem mapping tool to try to comprehend the context around technological education. So what are the gaps and opportunities to create this more profound implementation of these skills? So the subject of technological education is immensely large, and it is a domain that we wanted to get our hands in. But this tool really helped us, the ecosystem tool really helped us to guide us in which direction to actually take. So the first insight that we found is that we were going to work directly with the educators. So by doing this, it would enhance their understanding of the technological language, the tools, and thus they would take these skills to then design the curriculum to take to the classroom. This also allowed us to onboard different educators from the island, that in this particular case, there's only one school and one preschool establishment. So getting together with a couple of teachers would make the rest of them start getting involved and onboarding themselves to the project, inviting others to collaborate. So also creating a community between them. And after this, we also thought that we wanted to identify different hubs and technology clubs around Chile, being a very long country and them being more in isolation. We started collaborating with different of these actors around the country and also introducing this technological hub that we are trying to create in this broader network. So at the end of the day, ecosystem mapping really allowed us to define the scope, identify the users, the collaborators, and also to visualize these gaps that we had found to create the outputs and actual implementation of the project.
Great, thank you. And I'm going to talk about another project that I worked on. So I used to be a design researcher at the Wikimedia Foundation on the anti-harassment team, which is a sub-unit of the trust and safety team. So one of the things I worked on there was called the interaction timeline. So this project I'm going to talk about covers both ecosystem mapping and user research, because Wikimedia itself is an incredibly large ecosystem. We're talking hundreds of different language wikis, Wikimedia Commons, things called Village Pump, et cetera. These all sort of exist inside of this one space. One of the things that we actually like utilize inside of the Wikimedia community, something at the time we called the Wikimedia Community Wish List. How many of y'all have heard of this? So the community wish list was a way that across the year, different community members could list things that they would like to see the team I worked on there specifically focus on. I was on a team that was called community and building. So that would be like if you saw a bug on something you really wanted to fix, if there was a new feature you'd like to see, or if there was something that we should focus on. And then we would look at how people had sort of voted or ranked all the things that ended up on the wish list. We would go internally to our team and sort of talk about, okay, well, how difficult will it be to implement this one thing? If it's really easy, even if it's lower on the wish list, we are going to sort of like maybe prioritize building that really early on because it'll take a short amount of time. Other things might be very, very important but might take many years. And so what we would do is we would then present back to the community the wish list and say, here's the order of operations we're going to go in, and then here's our rationale. So this one thing you really want, we're going to take it back to like the board of Wikimedia and talk about how we actually need to fundraise for this thing, but it's maybe not something we can build this year. So the reason that that matters in the context of this thing called the interaction timeline is we get a lot of requests about updating tools and solving problems. And one of the things at the time that we were dealing with and Wikimedia is still dealing with is a well-known toxicity and harassment problem. Now, if you're not an editor, you might not know about this, but this is something a lot of editors deal with on a day-to-day basis, is sort of growing toxicity inside the community. So this is something we saw pop up again and again on the wish list. And so we were wondering, is there some kind of tool or intervention that we could engage with? For example, a lot of social networks like Reddit or Twitter have a variety of what we would call trust and safety tools that help them analyze and spot patterns inside of things like toxicity. And so we were thinking, is that something we can do? One of the things Wikimedia has, so we don't have moderators, we have editors. We have special roles that editors can hold called administrators. And those are actually the folks that when there is, let's say, some kind of disagreement inside of Wikimedia, the administrators will step in. Then there's a special committee called the Arbitration Committee when different kinds of harassment cases sort of keep ongoing and ongoing. You have to bring in this very special group. We like to sort of describe them as like the Supreme Court of the Wikimedia, of English language Wikipedia. And the reason that that matters is, when I worked at the Wikimedia Foundation in 2018, we knew that, again, the harassment was this really big issue. And we had seen sort of this request, again, for something to be done about it. So we sort of utilized requests from the community wish list, as well as just conversation that we had picked up from different Wikimedia conferences to sort of go back to the community and say, this is something we're going to focus on. Is this something you think we should focus on? And we got a lot of like, yes. But then what do we focus on? This is where user research comes in. So we did a variety of surveys and qualitative interviews with all different kinds of community members. So folks that ran specific meetups related to English language Wikipedia, like Women in Red, which is an initiative to get more female scientists inside of the encyclopedia. Also with folks that had faced high amounts of harassment, as well as different members of administrators in the arbitration committee, or ARBCOM, as we call it. We ran these two surveys and also, again, held in-person focus groups and then like one-on-one interviews at events. And so we had to sort of then present all this back to the community. All in all, I think we worked with or spoke to over 400 contributors. This also includes our surveys. We weren't, you know, one-to-one interviewing 400 people. But again, this really matters. And one of the things we kept hearing, or one of the things we sort of started to realize is that there might be a space for making a tool to alleviate certain problems we were having. And tool changes and prototyping might go a lot faster than us trying to change policy while we work towards changing or thinking about policy. Hold me a second. Yeah. And one of the things we kept hearing from these surveys and speaking to the administrators is this thing called sock puppeting. So sock puppeting is a major harm. It's where you sort of pretend to be a user, which you're not allowed to do. And so that was one thing that popped up that was a big concern. This is something where, let's say, someone who works for a film production company will write a page, like a wiki page about a movie. You're not allowed to do that because you're not allowed to be paid to write wiki pages. So we'd also see people who had been banned from one of the, from, let's say, English language Wikipedia coming back and creating a new account and then going and engaging further forms of toxicity. So we knew that this was a major problem. We also knew that something called wiki hounding, which is digital stalking, was also a problem. And so from our user research, we suddenly could isolate, right, these two major issues that we had to do something about. This helped us provide, again, examples like we could start creating these anonymized examples to better understand harassment and also present it back to the community. But from sock puppeting and wiki hounding, the reason I bring those up is we started to realize that there might actually be something we could use that could help ARB community administrators, which is trying to visualize the activity of a sock puppet account and potentially visualize the activity of someone engaging in wiki hounding or digital stalking. Because a lot of what we learned the metrics of those accounts would be doing is they would be editing or changing edits or, again, writing and doing something to engage with another user. And all this actually is trackable inside of the Wikimedia projects. So one of the things administrators mentioned over and over again was not being sure of what a sock puppet account was doing, of like how much damage, let's say, they had done inside the encyclopedia. Like, how could they understand to build a case to then say, like, maybe we should ban this account? Same with wiki hounding. How much, like, how long has this been going on? How do we know that it's happening? This sort of came up again and again and again in our findings. And so we created this tool that I'll quickly show you, and then I'll go back to this slide. So we created this tool called the Interaction Timeline. And the way that we also decided to create this tool is by engaging in ecosystem mapping to see what kinds of other tools existed. And it turns out that an editor 7 years prior to my team in 2018 starting this had built a tool called the Interaction Timeline. But it didn't have a visual interface to it. So all you could see was like line, 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 line. And it hadn't been maintained. So one of the things we thought was, maybe this is something that could actually be helpful. We created a series of wireframes. We tested with different members who are administrators in ARBCOM to see what they would think. And we also tested with high-impact editors who did not hold those roles. We actually got a lot of really great feedback. One thing I will say is we designed this for the Wikimedia community. So a big thing was, can you have there be less space? Can you have there be like less color? Meaning like they like things very condensed and sort of close together. We were like, yeah, we can do that. Why not? So then just sort of going back to this, the success of the tool was very action specific. It's one small tool inside of a large ecosystem of problems. The goal is not, like, we cannot fix harassment with one tool and with the action of like one piece of software, but it was something we knew that would alleviate the pain administrators were facing. Because to report harassment inside of Wikimedia, there's not a reporting tool. You go to a public page called admins.nosport/incidents, and you have to write what is happening. And admins then have to go and track down what is happening between two users. And this tool has been very integral in those administrators to see what happens. Because the administrators are the ones that weigh in and make a decision on any kind of action. So if they ban someone from like interacting with another user, they have to back up why, because it's Wikimedia. You have to cite your sources. So anyway, we're at time. I'm going to quickly say this really quickly. How did this sort of use both user research and ecosystem mapping? The user research helped us realize we had a problem. Toxicity and helped us sort of find actually very specific nuances to that problem. It allowed us to sort of hear and see what day-to-day administrators were facing and understanding some of the major issues they had, which was admins.nosport/incidents, that it was a very toxic place, but it was like the place that they had to engage in. And what they needed was help in understanding the cases. This is where this tool came in. We also looked at other tools inside of the trust and safety world to see if there was some other kind of tool we could use. So we also looked outside of the Wikimedia ecosystem. But we realized that a tool that an editor made was the best one. And also for us, the reason that we also wanted to work on that tool and maintain that tool is because it came from the community and was designed for our community. And so we went and asked that editor, do you mind if we update this? And he said, yes, of course. So then now it's something that's updated and maintained by the foundation, by a specific team. So we know that it's continually maintained and updated. And one last thing I'll say really quickly is, regardless of your project or product or community, it's always worth thinking about consistent ways for your users to give feedback and interact with you. And that's a big thing we had at Wikimedia. We had a very special page for our team. We had a community liaison who sat on our team. So you could always leave comments or email us. And we shared everything in real time also on Wiki, so people could provide real feedback, also with the suggestion of please email us. We'd also set up one-on-one interviews. So thank you. We're Convocation.